introduce Sally. Sally's Associate Professor at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, and she did her undergraduate there, her Master's at the University of Cape Town, and then her PhD back at Wits. And then for 10 years she worked as a research scientist at CSIRR, which is a research institute in the network in South Africa. And 5 years ago she came back as professor at Wits. And she works on lots of things, lots of really interesting things, including this work about consumer control in grassy ecosystems. So, welcome.
Great. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's exciting to be able to give a talk here among people who perhaps haven't spent a lot of time thinking about grassy ecosystems, but there seems to be a lot more enthusiasm and interest for us to share knowledge and ideas. So I'm hoping there'll be some commonalities in this talk that we can engage on. About more than 10 years ago now, William Bond and John Keeley published a paper that I consider quite seminal, where the title is Fire as a Global Herbivore, and the aim of this paper really was to draw parallels between fire and herbivores as alternative consumers of vegetation, and particularly to try to compare fire as a consumer that's analogous to herbivory. And the origin of this was that fire ecologists had been slightly, I suppose, fire ecology wasn't necessarily very, I mean, the idea was to bring trophic ecology and bring trophic ecologists to start to think about how fire works from an ecological perspective. And a few years later, the first remotely sensed data of fires appeared. And these days, it would be hard to imagine people not thinking about fire as a globally important consumer, because we have this really good global scale measurements of how much biomass is consumed by fire. And people have recognized this is actually carbon consumed. So people have used this to understand the Earth system impacts of fire, but also from an ecological perspective to understand its importance in the ecology, especially in these tropical systems where we have such frequent fires. And trophic ecology then, I suppose, was a bit behind the game, because although trophic ecologists had always been very interested in herbivores and how they worked, we never had this big global scale perspective on herbivory. But recently, colleagues from around the world, and particularly from here, have been trying to produce the similar level estimates for herbivores, and now we are able to globally compare fire and herbivores. So I think this is a paper from this research group which tries to estimate the amount of dry matter consumed by herbivores globally. And the units are the same. So although fire does consume more than herbivory, that's basically the same order of magnitudes in terms of the amount of biomass being consumed. So let's think a little bit about these two consumers, if we both agree that they're important consumers. And if we're trying to contrast them, the first thing to notice is that fire is a physical process and herbivory is a biological one. And this is fundamental, and we'll talk about some of those things later. And then in terms of time, fire is stochastic from day to day. It seldom occurs more than once a year, so there's strong seasonal dynamics. There's a fire season when the systems are flammable. Whereas herbivores, because they are living, they are continuously present from day to day in the landscape. But we often get decadal dynamics where herbivores, due to disease or drought, they show decadal scale patterns. In terms of space, fire often is thought to remove heterogeneity and be quite a uniform consumer. Whereas herbivory by nature is patchy, herbivores tend to create heterogeneity in landscapes. So already there are strong contrasts between these different types of consumers. I'm going to come back to this, but when it comes to selectivity, people have often talked about fire as the greatest, most non-selective consumer. But I'd like to argue that fire is actually just equally as selective as herbivory. It just selects for a very different type of forage. So herbivores are looking for a forage with a low C2N ratio that matches their own stoichiometry. They're looking for a moist forage that will help them to gain the water that they need. And then herbivores also want to forage with a high bulk density, so it makes that every time they take a bite, they're getting a lot of food. Whereas fire burns much more easily through dry fuel, so for dry fuel, a high C2N ratio makes plants much more flammable, and a low bulk density allows more oxygen to penetrate. So the types of fuels that forage is selected for are totally contrasting. Fire needs continuity in space, because without this, fires will go out. So you need to have fuel or forage everywhere. Whereas herbivores can move around. They don't need spatial continuity, but they need the food to be available all the time. So there's some very strong differences between these consumers, even though they both occur in the same environments. And here are just some pictures to demonstrate the range of herbivores and the range of fires that we get in savanna ecosystems in Africa. So we get selective herbivores who will be quite particular about the type of food they eat. We get these non-selective herbivores that are more like lawnmowers that will just go through eating whatever forage is available. And then this is a landscape, but perhaps it's easier to see over here, which indicates a landscape after herbivory. So these are hippo grazing lawns, and the hippos have left the forage that they don't like. So they have selected for the food that they like. And similarly with fire, this is a landscape after a fire event. You can see that like the herbivores, the fire has consumed its preferred forage and left its non-preferred forage. So both of these consumers respond to vegetation composition. That's one of the things that drives them. But they also, we know very well, they also act to as strong environmental filters, and they act to control vegetation composition and species dynamics. But if we just focus for now on how these systems, how these consumers are responding to environmental conditions, we've pulled together some data in Africa that looks at the amount of fire in terms of the median fraction burned, and the amount of herbivores in terms of herbivore density. These data are from the livestock data set, then filled with information that we've produced with Gareth Hempson on indigenous herbivores. So these are current day measures of herbivore density and fraction burned across a rainfall gradient in Africa. And you can see that although both fire and herbivory peak at intermediate rainfalls, herbivores, because they're not so dependent on the amount of forage and they depend more on the quality of the forage, tend to peak at lower rainfalls, whereas fire peaks at higher rainfalls. These patterns are modified, they're certainly modified by soils. So if you add soil nutrients to that, you find that you tend to find, this index over here is the proportion of biomass consumed that's consumed by herbivores. So herbivores, at high rainfalls, they consume more biomass if the soils are fertile. So again, because herbivores are focused on forage quality and having a low C2N ratio, they only tend to be dominant consumers when the forage quality is good. And people have known this for a long time in Africa. We have this concept in Africa of rich savannas and poor savannas. Rich savannas being low rainfall savannas with high soil nutrients, which are generally have lots of herbivores in them, and poor savannas being high rainfall systems with less nutrients, which tend to have more fire. So this is stuff we've known for a while, it's just now we're able to map it. The other thing we're now able to do, because we have the data, is to compare these consumers in terms of common units. It's hard to compare herbivore density and fraction burned, but you can turn both of these indices into an index of dry matter consumed. And if you look at dry matter consumed, now fire is the darker line and herbivores are the grey line, it's clear that fire actually does consume a lot more biomass across all the aspects of the rainfall gradient than herbivores do. Largely because even when elephants can knock down trees, but they don't tend to eat trees, whereas fire can actually consume woody biomass. So in terms of biomass consumed, you find the same regional changes in the consumers. You still have some areas where herbivores are consuming more biomass than fire is, but it definitely consumes a lot. But if you think about methane emitted, because of the differences between fire and herbivory, herbivores are decomposing food in a very anoxic environment. Herbivores emit almost as much methane as fire does, even though they consume less biomass. So when it comes to earth system impacts, whether you've got herbivores or fire consuming the food in the ecosystem makes a big difference to your greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, if you do the numbers, currently herbivores emit about 4.1 teragrams of methane per year in Africa. But in the past, when we had a lot more big herbivores, and big herbivores emit more methane per unit area, per unit weight, herbivores probably emitted more methane than fire does. So there's been big shifts in the consumers in Africa that have had implications for biomass consumed and methane emissions. Now, these interactions, like the environmental limits that we show, you, though they've got different limits, there's still a large area of Africa, a large area of environmental space where both of these consumers are at quite high levels. And so when you have both consumers in the same environmental conditions, there definitely are some interactions between these two consumers. Fire affects the type and degree of herbivory, and herbivory affects the type and degree of fire. So we've been doing a lot of work recently. There's fabulous research on fire and herbivores, but not a lot of research looking at their interactions. So we've been doing quite a lot of research trying to show how to understand these impacts of these consumers together. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the interactions we've been analyzing and looking at. And the real question we've been asking is, are these consumers enabling? Do they enable each other, or are they antagonistic? And when it comes to browsers, I'm going to briefly brush over my opinion about what happens with browsers, although my colleague Gareth Hempson has got a book chapter out looking more in detail browsers and herbivores. And it's probably a bit risky for me talking to a whole lot of forest ecologists to slide on a fire, start ignoring the trees entirely. But I do feel browsers clearly enable fire by keeping systems open, and there's quite a lot of data on that, and people in this room are looking at those sorts of processes. There's also some evidence that fire enables browsers, because if fires keep trees short, then they're within the browse line. So the summary that I would like to say is that generally between browsers and fire you have enabling interactions. But then what about grazers and fire? So I'm going to be heading into a world of grass for the rest of this talk, and I hope that I can take some of you with me. The grazing impact on fire is actually quite easy to measure. Nice thing about grass is it's easy to measure and it grows very quickly. We have some good data from Tlatelolco Park showing that, well, let me just first show you some pictures. This is a picture taken in the Serengeti just as the wildebeest migration moved through. And before the wildebeest migration came through, this was tall grassland. And within a few days, it had been grazed totally short. And this is a picture. Maybe it's easier to look here. Here's a picture of a fire that we lit in the Sitara landscape in the Kruger National Park, which went out a few minutes after I took the photograph, because basically there was too much short grass in the system. It had been heavily grazed by animals, and the fire couldn't percolate through the system. So because grazers eat the fuel that fire needs, and grazers are available all year round, and fire's only over there in the dry season, fire tends to be suppressed by heavy grazing. And we have some data from Tlatelolco Park showing that. This is the proportion of tall grass in the landscape. And when the proportion of tall grass drops below about 0.6, 60% tall grass, fires can no longer percolate through that system. So if grazers can keep grass short enough, then fire cannot spread. And this threshold that we found from field data in Tlatelolco Park fits beautifully with theoretical percolation thresholds. If you think of fire as an infection process and run some models, basically the percolation threshold for fire is at exactly 60%, which is quite astounding, and something that we're wanting to pursue perhaps with Annabelle later. So there's also evidence at a larger scale. These are very small plot scales. There's evidence at a larger scale that grazers and fire compete with each other. In the Serengeti, the wildebeest numbers were very low for many years because of the rinderpest. And when the rinderpest stopped in the 1960s, the wildebeest numbers increased quite rapidly. And as the wildebeest numbers increased, Norton Griffiths showed how the fire percentage area burn decreased across the park. And the conclusion there was that as wildebeest started eating the food, fires burned less. So that's over time. This is over time from 1964 to 1974. Then Carlos Staver has also shown in terms of space that when you have a lot of grazers in the system, you have less frequent fire. And we've also got some data from the Kruger National Park. In the Kruger Park, they used to try to control their herbivores at very low numbers. And so they had quite an active culling program for several decades where they culled elephants and they culled buffalo and they culled impala and was keeping the animal numbers low. And then in the early 1990s, they stopped all culling immediately, and animal numbers have increased dramatically, especially the large animals like hippo and buffalo and elephant. And if we just, the rainfall isn't significantly different between these time periods, but if we compare the area burned in arid and semi-arid systems during culling and after culling, you can see that after culling, basically by stopping culling, we have dramatically reduced the amount of fire in Kruger. Inadvertently, no one realized this. It wasn't the intention of the managers. So this is a paper we just have in prep, which is looking at the consequences of a management intervention on the fire regime that no one really thought about. So that's quite easy, the impact of grazes on fire. The impact of fire on grazes is a bit harder to understand, possibly because fire is a physical process, so grazes impact fire is quite easy physics to understand, physics of percolation. When it comes to fire's impact on grazing, grazes are making decisions about where they want to eat, but fires alter the landscape for them. Immediately after a fire, many grazes are attracted because after a fire, new green grass is growing, which is very palatable. It's got a high nitrogen content, a high sugar content. So for a few months, it's a really good landscape for grazes to be in. But over long time periods, fire effects can be quite negative on grazes. And this is because fires affect the species composition. So I have a little schematic trying to talk about how we think fires interact with herbivores in an ecosystem. And this is from some work we did quite a long time ago in the film Bilosi Park. So usually, as I mentioned, grazes tend to be quite heterogeneous. They graze in small patches. They create habitats of grazing lawn landscape that they prefer. And then after a fire comes through, these patchy landscapes are no longer any more attractive than the rest of the landscape. So fire creates a tasty landscape everywhere. So fire disperses the grazes throughout the landscape. And fire removes that heterogeneity that was created by the grazes, because these patches are only maintained through heavy grazing. If the grazes disappear, the short grasses are outcompeted by tall grasses. So frequent fires in the system, frequent large fires, tend to create these tall, homogeneous tall grass landscapes, which are not actually preferred by most grazes. Just to give you some data to show how different these landscapes are in terms of forage, a grazing lawn system with these short grazing lawn grasses can have quite high nitrogen and phosphorus content, 18 and 3. After a fire, the whole landscape has quite high nitrogen and phosphorus content, estimates of about 15 and 2.1, so equivalent to what you get on a grazing lawn. But in this tall grass landscape, which is the usual state for these systems, the nitrogen and phosphorus is almost half what it is on these lawns. So the frequent fires are maintaining the system in a type of habitat that very few grazes can find nutritious enough to survive. We have some data on this from Fluvium Pelosi Park, where we've created these short grass patches and then just monitored whether they persisted in the landscape or whether they grew up again. And what really mattered was whether there was fire. So in parts of the park where we asked the rangers to burn and there were fires all around, the short grass patches disappeared and became part of the tall grass landscape. And then there were other parts of the park where we asked the rangers not to burn, so there was no fire that year, and then the short grass patches persisted. So the effect of large fires is to disperse animals and to get rid of these short, patchy systems. So it gets really interesting because the interactions between these two consumers are mediated by the grass communities that each consumer creates. So theoretically, we have these two very different types of grasslands that can occur in the same ecosystem, on the same soils, with the same rainfall. You have tall tussock grasslands with frequent fire. They're not favored by most grazers, although there's some grazers that have specialized into this habitat. And then you have short grazing lawns, which are heavily used by many types of grazers. And in these lawns, fire can't percolate because the grass is too short. And the types of grass species in these systems are incredibly different. Grass belongs to one family, but it has an amazing variety of growth forms. So tall tussock grasses like this can reach up and 2 meters tall above my head. Or you have these creeping grasses, people call them sod-forming grasses, that grow laterally, and you can see have very different leaf properties to the tall grasses. I should mention here that heavy grazing doesn't always result in these luscious-looking lawns. Except in England, everywhere I travel around England, I have never seen any bare ground. I saw one little patch of bare ground. But sometimes heavy grazing can result in increase in bare ground, and then the existence of only very unpalatable species that the animals don't want to eat. So these sorts of Aristida type of species. And we have a whole project going at the moment trying to understand under what conditions heavy grazing creates these palatable, productive, beautiful lawns, which are increase animal numbers, and under what conditions you end up with this degraded system, which actually can't support a lot of animals. So I'm not going to go into that, but there are some quite interesting questions around when these different systems emerge. But in many of the national parks that I work in, heavy grazing creates these grazing lawn systems which are preferred by animals. So just a little schematic about all the things that I've been talking to you about. We have some positive feedbacks where if you have short grazing lawn ecosystems, then animals prefer that and they come and they persist and maintain these grazing lawns. And where we have tall grasslands, then they're flammable and then that promotes more fires. So you have positive feedbacks on either of these sides. Grazing promotes short grass ecosystems that restrict fire, and fire promotes tall grass ecosystems that most grazers avoid. So I mentioned that these systems can occur in the same rainfall in the same soils, which means there's a chance for these systems to switch from one to the other. When I first produced this data looking at herbivores and fire a couple of years ago, I was quite intrigued to compare that with what we have in the Kruger National Park. The Kruger National Park is quite a large area. It's the size of Israel, actually. So it covers a large rainfall gradient from about 400 to 700 mils of rain. But over the whole park, there's a lot more fire than you would expect for that rainfall based on what occurs in the rest of Africa. And there are a lot fewer herbivores than you would expect for that rainfall. So the idea was that perhaps in the Kruger National Park, the fire regime that they have been implementing for the last several decades has been promoting fire and at the same time restricting herbivory. The Kruger Park had a very controlled fire management program for many years where they burned large blocks every 3 years, huge, massive fires, which tended to homogenize the landscape. And when we presented these data to people in Kruger, they were starting to think that perhaps Kruger would obviously like to have more herbivores because of what attracts the tourists are the herbivores. So they were like, well, maybe we can play around with our fire regime, see if we could switch the system back from a fire-dominated one to a herbivore-dominated system. So we started an experiment in Kruger, in Sotara, where we ingeniously, I thought, decided to try to create these herbivore systems by burning small fires, because if large fires disperse herbivores, small fires would potentially concentrate them. If you had a little small burnt patch with green grass in the middle of a landscape full of tall, untasted grass, then the animals will come and create these patches. So we initiated some small burns. Maybe I should show you here. We initiated some small burns in a tall grass landscape dominated by tall Wathria chloa thermida. And the burns were quite small, like 50 by 50 meters, 200 meters. And the animals came, the wildebeest came. Here's data on dung counts on our treatment, our small fires, and on our control. And you can see that we definitely managed to double the amount of herbivory just through these treatments. And after we applied fires in 2013 and 2014, but after that the system had become a short grass system. We could no longer burn. We tried to apply the fires, but they didn't spread because of the percolation problem. But the animals stayed because they had created their preferred habitat. So we ended up, we managed to create grazer habitat in the middle of a fire world. And these sorts of switches. So just to show how easy, it really just took us 4 years to do that. So these systems have been switching perhaps from fire to grazer-dominated systems quite frequently. There's some ideas from Tlutlu and Velozi Park, where people looked at the type of trees and how old they were. This is Carlos Stader and William Bond. And the Acacia nilotica is a herbivore-adapted tree that can handle intense herbivory, but is not very resistant to fire. And herbivore-adapted Acacia nilotica is recruited in 1960 when we had very, very high herbivore numbers, and then there was an intense culling campaign because they were worried about how many herbivores there were in the system. And then in the 1980s, we had the most intense fires and widespread fires in Kruger. And since then, the canopy trees have switched from being Acacia nilotica to Acacia karoo, which is a fire adapted species. So, in the historical record we have for Tlutlu and Velozi Park, the park has switched from a herbivore dominated to a fire dominated system, while the rainfall and the soils have maintained the same. So then once we knew this, we were intrigued to see how our patterns looked across space. I've shown you this data already. I showed it to you in a graph format, but this is a map now of where we get a lot of fire and where we get a lot of herbivory in Africa. And as I showed you before, if you look at a histogram of the proportion of primary productivity consumed by herbivores. In low rainfall environments, almost 100% of the consumption occurs through herbivory. In high rainfall environments, almost 100% of the consumption occurs through fire. And then what you would expect in the middle would be that you'd have, I don't know, a nice unimodal graph where about 50% of it's herbivory, 50% of it's fire. But what you actually find is that if you look at a per pixel basis, you have pixels, parts of the landscape that are either fire dominated or herbivore dominated. But you hardly ever get systems in Africa where both consumers are equally prevalent. So you get this interesting bimodality in the consumption in this intermediate rainfall portion of Africa. Now, one way to explain this could be humans, and I will talk about humans a bit later, but it has really interesting analogies with, or parallels with, the evidence that we, among other people, have been finding for forests of other alternative stable states. Oh, so I have got some trees in this. Just to wake you guys all up, we started to go back to thinking about forests of other states. When Carla and I first started looking at the tree cover data for Africa back in the late 2000s, we also found this interesting bimodality. And this was a bimodality of tree cover. And we found that you had systems that were either forest or either savanna, but you hardly ever had systems that were intermediate tree cover. And this was can be explained through models that many people have been working on and thinking about in terms of the positive feedbacks you get in forests, where forests keep fire out through suppressing grass, and savannas keep forest out through having frequent fire. And there's lots of wonderful theoretical models that can predict these bimodalities. So in the evidence for a very, like, there's a lot of interest in forest savanna boundaries and alternative stable states, but actually there are some really interesting dynamics happening in the grass layer, which might also have some interesting feedbacks and interesting alternative stable states occurring within the grass layer that actually might be quite a little bit more tangible and easier for us to get on top of. So if you think about how these alternate states might emerge in the grass layer, I've already showed you that grazing promotes the spread of short grass patches and bare ground, because grazers consume and create these short grass patches. And I've showed you that fire impedes the spread of short grass through dispersing animals in the landscape. And I've also showed you that there's a threshold proportion of short grass where fire is excluded. So that this could be a kind of key threshold in the system, where if the system goes above this, you're into a fire system and grazes start to be suppressed, and if it goes below this, you're into a grazing system and fire starts to be suppressed. So you can predict a hysteresis in the system if you're just looking at the proportion of short grass. Whereas grazes numbers increase, short grass increases, but fire is keeping the short grass suppressed. And then you get to the fire threshold where fire gets switched off, at which point you immediately have a lot more short grass in the system, and you jump up to a system with quite a lot of short grass, at which point, even if you reduce the grazer numbers, you're not going to bring fire back into the system because there's too much short grass. So you can predict this sort of hysteresis. And that could then explain the bimodality that you get in fire and herbivory. So I think I've managed to show you in the last couple of slides that fire and grazing-dominated systems are certainly alternative states, because we have evidence that the same system has switched from a fire to a herbivore-dominated one over time. Whether they are alternative stable states remains to be proved, but there's a lot of intriguing evidence that potentially there are some positive feedbacks that mean that once you switch into a system, chances are it will stay in that system unless something pushes it out again. For example, our experiment in the Kruger Park. But I suppose for the rest of this talk, I want to talk a little bit about what needs to be done to understand these alternative stable states. Because explaining the feedbacks within fire and within short grass systems requires that we understand the life histories of the grass communities a little bit more. We have to think about what creates a fire-dominated system, a fire-adapted grass, or a grazer-adapted grass. So here are my classic fire and grazer-adapted grasses. And the question that we're asking at the moment are that what traits and trait syndromes are successful in fire-prone versus herbivore-prone environments? And why are these two grasslands so distinct, considering that they are both need to survive in a system where their above-ground biomass gets consumed? Now, in order to get at this, unfortunately, think we're going to have to totally upheave decades of history in trophic ecology, because trophic ecologists have thought have a really clear and well-coordinated way of thinking about herbivore adaptations. And then fire ecologists also have a very clear and well-coordinated way of thinking about fire adaptations. But unfortunately, it's not very easy to compare the two theoretical ideas. So we've got a paper in Ecology Letters at the moment, which is probably going to be slammed by the reviewers because it's suggesting a whole new set of definitions and a whole new theory, but at least it allows us to think about herbivores and fire in the same way. And the fundamentals of it is that you have to think about these two different axes when you're thinking about an adaptation. You have to think about attraction, the attraction avoidance continuum, how palatable or flammable is a particular life history. So that's classic trait people would perhaps call those effect traits. And then you have to think about tolerance. If a plant is consumed, can it survive the defoliation event? And can the species persist in an environment that's exposed to frequent herbivory? And classic trait people would consider those response traits, I suppose. You've got effect traits and you've got response traits. But together, those things describe your life history strategy in a consumer environment. So if you remember, we actually have a lot of information about the first one, the attraction avoidance continuum, because we know what sorts of forage or what sorts of fuels most herbivores of fire need. I'll show you some pictures. It's always nicer with pictures. This is the sort of food that an animal likes to eat. Low C2N ratio, high bulk density, high leaf water content. This is the type of forage food that a fire likes to eat. High C2N ratio, low bulk density, low leaf water content. So the implications of this is that grasses that are palatable are seldom flammable, and grasses that are flammable are seldom palatable, and that a life history strategy that avoids grazing by being unpalatable automatically makes a plant more likely to be flammable, and the other way around. So there's no way to avoid both consumers, basically. So then what about tolerance? What about the other axis that we need to think about? Fire and herbivory both consume above ground material. So the questions we've been asking a lot is whether fire tolerance traits are similar to grazing tolerance traits. So do fire and grazing filter grass communities in the same way? And here's a picture of a grass responding after a fire, just to give you a bit of an idea of the type of traits that are required to respond after a fire event. You need to be able to resprout clearly, and you need to be able to grow very fast, and all of your buds need to be protected. And clearly, all of those characteristics, you need that if you're being grazed as well as if you're being burned. But on the other hand, we have lots of field evidence showing that fire and grazing don't filter communities in the same way. Here's some data from the Serengeti looking at how fire frequency affects the proportion of Themida triandra in a system. Themida triandra is what we call classic fire grass. It's incredibly flammable. And it's clearly promoted by frequent fire. And then our experiment in the Kruger National Park already, although there's plenty of other evidence, shows that even after about 4 years, we had a fire system where fires were very frequent. We had all these classic fire, we call them fire climax grasslands, because the climax vegetation under a fire regime has got certain species in it. We took this fire climax grassland. After only 4 years, we had changed the species composition. When we did a ordination, this axis relates to more grazing. Once we added grazes to the system, we had species. And these species have a high leaf moisture content and a low C2N ratio. So when we added grazes to a system, we filtered out the fire species and we created more palatable species. So grazing creates more palatable, less palatable grasslands. Whether they're more productive or not is a question that we're still trying to resolve, because that would be the final question about whether it's promoting herbivores, because even if it's more palatable, if there's not a lot of food, it could be an issue. So grazing and fire don't filter communities in the same way. And intriguingly, plants that are tolerant of grazing also happen to be palatable, and plants that are tolerant of fire also happen to be flammable. And that is quite intriguing, because why on earth should those two things go together? Unless it advantages grasses, fire grasses, to be flammable. So just to summarise, we're still working on this, but clearly both for fire and flammability, you need to be able to restrike rapidly. But fire grasses tend to grow tall, and herbivore-tolerant grasses tend to grow laterally. So some tolerance traits are shared, but not all.
Which implies there's no ideal tolerance strategy. There's no grass strategy that allows you to do well in fire and grazing environments.
So, just to summarise where we're at with trying to understand fire and grazer functional traits. As I've mentioned, the traits that confer flammability and those that confer palatability are very different from each other, and this does lend support to the alternative stable state ideas presented earlier, because it means that once you're in a system that's flammable, it's less likely to have herbivores in it. So the positive feedbacks are promoted by the different selective needs of these two consumers. When it's a work in progress to contrast fire and grazing tolerance traits, but we do expect a distinction between species that are specialised for each consumer. And then these are some unresolved questions, although Huli Pausas has done a great job of trying to explain why fire-tolerant grasses are intrinsically more flammable. There's some ideas that actually being flammable is in itself a fire-tolerance trait, because if you create the term fast flammable, plants that promote fires that spread quickly through the overstory, then are protecting their buds by drawing the fire away from the sensitive buds and up into the overstory. So there's an idea that actually one really good fire tolerance strategy is to be flammable, and that might explain why these two things are correlated when we look at data. The question of why grazing tolerant grasses are intrinsically more palatable, people haven't assessed as much as fire fighters, but I can think of some reasons potentially why grazing might filter for more palatable species. Just a little plug, while I have some people available, we're starting a new Royal Society funded grant where we're quantifying changes in traits and community composition across a rainfall gradient and across gradients of fire and grazing. It's going to involve a lot of field work. We're looking for a postdoc and a research assistant to work on this project, and we're also looking for collaborators to add more sites, because as you can see, we're a bit focused on the east side of Africa. So there's going to be some fun tests of some of the theory. If the reviewers of ecology letters don't like it, perhaps in a few years we'll have some data to test some of our new ideas. And then I just wanted to take a bit of a step back and think in a broader context. If you think about the grass family, the fascinating thing about tropical grasslands or grasslands in general is that they're dominated by one family, which makes it really interesting because we know a lot about its evolutionary history. And we know that many of the fire-adapted grasses that we see, the ones that are promoting fires, are clustered in the grass phylogeny. It's really within the entire grass phylogeny. It's only the Andropogini, within the Palaeocoeni, that have these characteristics that make them flammable and fire-tolerant. On the other hand, we suspect that grazer adaptations are more widely distributed. Grazing occurs in temperate systems as well as tropical systems, so potentially that's something that grasses have had a longer time to have to evolve adaptations to. There's some lovely data that Caroline Lehman and her colleagues have put together that pulls on a global data set that they've produced looking at different grass clades, and the correlation between the Andropogony, which is this orange line, and the fire return interval, and the black, which is the black line, is quite striking. So it's very clear that these particular types of grasses are the ones that are driving and creating the types of savanna fire regimes that we see today. So to conclude, for a wide range of environmental conditions, the dominant consumer is not set. So the type of ecosystem that you see in many savanna environments, and when you're looking at the grasslands, really depends on the history of drought and disease. Disease in the case of Serengeti, past management in the case of the Kruger National Park, which has had quite a hands-on management program. And grass community switches in response to fire and grazing reinforce particular consumer regimes. So once management or drought or disease has created an ecosystem, then there are feedbacks which make that system persist. What we know about fire and herbivore functional traits in grasses then supports the idea that we have alternative stable states between fire and grazer-dominated grass communities. But identifying and quantifying these traits will help us to understand the evolutionary pathways by which fire and herbivore tolerance and adaptations have spread through the grass family.
I suppose just to touch on some of the other ideas we're thinking about, I've already mentioned that we're starting a big project where we're doing some field work to test some of this theory. We're also really interested in looking at the consequences of grazing and fire adaptations for other aspects of plant biology. Because when I speak to many people about grazing adaptations, they tell me, oh no, that's a drought adaptation, and it's the same with fire. So grasses cover a massive environmental range, from arid systems to really mesic systems, temperature limited. So we're really interested in how other drivers of, particularly how drought adaptations are associated with fire and other leaf traits. So we're starting a greenhouse experiment on that. And then there is a lot of application for this work, considering rangelands and grasslands support tremendous numbers of people, and that there's a large concern about degradation in these grasslands. How can we use these ideas and understand these, the ecology of grazing and fire, especially thinking about the genetic backpack of particular grass communities? There was some lovely work by Malchunas many decades ago saying that whether a system became degraded or not really depended on the evolutionary history of grazing in that system. So we're hoping we can add some more support to that by making it more quantitative. I just want to thank my key collaborators of this work. Catherine Parr, Gareth Hibson, and Caroline Lehman have all contributed a lot. We had some funding from the NSF, which funded our project in Kruger, and we now have the Royal Society grant, which is allowing us to take this region. And then I have a great team of students, ranging from field ecologists to taxonomists. So